Oh, you all hear me? Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. Let me start my PowerPoint. I'm sure you're excited. You're going to get a PowerPoint. But really, the purpose of me being here is I'm speaking to the choir, I'm sure. I'm sure that most of you are already fairly committed to the idea of homeschooling. And so when I come to these homeschool conventions, it's a little bit more of here's what I've learned. And this is what the seminar is about, is how what I've learned about the apologetic of being a homeschooler. And what do we need to know in terms of defending homeschooling and being the apologist for homeschooling? Because that's kind of the work we've got to do. In fact, I was just talking to Michael Moody, who runs Forge, and that was our conversation. You know, Texas is, you know, a great state. In fact, it's one of the best states, you have to admit. But it's not. That's me pandering. I'm from Texas too. Not originally, but the the thing about Texas, as you know, is that there's a problem, and there's a churchianity. There's lots of people that are Christian, lots of people going to church. Big churches packed to the gills, and what do we find? Not a lot of them homeschooling. In fact, we've found that with indoctrination as we go around to these churches. Do you want to show this film indoctrination? In fact, it's often, very often, people in the church who have seen our film, and they say, oh, you know, call me up and say, we loved your film. I'm going to go to the session to ask to show the film. And of course, they call me back 3 weeks later, and they're devastated. This church said, no way are we going to show this film. And that's very common. We've shown our film very rarely in Texas. It's shown all across the country, and there has been churches that have shown it. But, you know, Texas is still as stubborn. I think it's one of those things that we're going to talk about in terms of the apologetics angle of why people justify what they do. And one of the angles is our schools are different. And this is one of the ideas we had to bring up in the film. So how are you going to reach out to these public schooling parents? This is our job. We're not just asking people to be homeschoolers because we think we're cool being homeschoolers and that's the way it should be, or we're better. This is a life and death issue, which is why we wanted to make indoctrination, why we still want to get the message out, is that getting people away from the public school system is literally life and death. If not, spiritual harm will come on all children in the public schools. Physical harm will come as well. And we saw that recently, another event in Houston this week. So why do we make documentaries? I didn't always make documentaries. I mean, nearly 10 years I've been making documentaries. When we bring out our new film next year, that will be our 10th year. So 10 years after our first film, Shaky Town. And I've never been full-time in documentary filmmaking until the last couple of years. I wanted to do something for the Lord, for the kingdom of God, and use my skills, which are minimal. I'm not an academic. I could never write a book, although I did write a book, but only wrote one. I only wrote the introduction, which is a real cheat. So I've got a book published, and I only wrote like 2 pages. So I'm not particularly good at that. But what I was good at was thinking creatively. I'm from an architecture background, and then I went into video games, believe it or not. I worked in the video game industry, Atari, and was looking for something to do with the gifts that God had given me, and video games wasn't the way to go. And so I realized documentary films, and documentary films are the best kind of films out there. Y'all watch movies, and real movies are... feature films, and that's fine. And I love the Kendrick brothers, and I love all that they do, and I love all those guys who are involved in Christian filmmaking. Documentaries are better. They're more direct. We're able to say exactly what we want to say, and we don't have to work with actors. We don't have to couch everything with, you know, let's try and put in a little word here, a little symbolism there. We just say what we want to say. Documentaries have become very much the way that the world is talking to each other. There's a lot of debate going on in the documentary world. We all know Food Inc. We know a handful of other documentary films. These films have a big worldview impact and change a lot of people's minds and change exactly what they're doing with their lives. And so for me, I realized very early on, this was the best way for me to go. not the entertainment route, which I'm fine with that, but this acceptable form of media, the documentary film, was the way to go. And I realized we needed an independent Christian voice. Back in 2004, when we started this, when we were filming Shaky Town, there was hardly any Christian documentarians that we knew of. We've now met a few of them. Obviously, there's been significant documentaries historically. In the past, you know, Francis Schaeffer had made documentaries. The Silent Scream is a good example of a very impactful documentary. Hell's Bells. So there's these other films out there that I knew about, and actually ended up meeting some of the people that had made those excellent films. So I was in love with documentaries because I knew they changed me. The Silent Scream being a good example of a film where you were like, didn't know something, and then you see it in front of your eyes, and then you think differently and act differently as a result of what you see. It's very interesting about how seeing something changes your perspective, and this is very true for documentary films. What someone told me, they wrote me a letter after Monstrous Regiment came out. I don't know if you've heard of Monstrous Regiment, it's about feminism. And, you know, it shows the virtue of a lifestyle that involves staying at home, not working, and having kids. You know, it's like that. So we say that's a good thing, not a bad thing, like all the media and politicians will tell you. And someone wrote to me saying, you know, it was really interesting that the response I got from my family is I'd been doing this in front of them for years, but it wasn't until they saw your film that they started to think about it. And that's a part of the part. That's not exactly a good thing, but that's a part of the way we are as a culture, is that we respond very well to media. Unless we see it on a screen in the wall, it will not have the traction. So using media wisely is a really good way to go. So that we realized that was what we needed to do. And of course, the opportunity for us is to present ideas that are non-mainstream. I think every idea I have isn't very mainstream. All of you as well are counterculture very significantly. We're not following the ways of the world, so everything we say will be very often antithetical to what is being presented on the other side. So we're presenting ideas, and this is true in documentary filmmaking, and the advantage is you're getting an independent voice. You're finding a voice that's mine. So when we present Indoctrination, it's not just my voice because there's a team of people that work on it. But what it comes across as is, this is Colin Gunn. This isn't MSNBC. This isn't CNN. This isn't, you know, Viacom or any big company. It's just me. And that's why we make independent Christian films. We say exactly what we want to say. We don't need a big budget. We can just do it and get it out there. And so we don't care who we offend, which is usually quite a lot of people. The other aspect why documentaries are good is that they're effective. Real stories change people's lives. Now, if I was to pick a feature film, a narrative that I would do, it would probably be some true story. I like true stories. I'm fine with theater and actors and even video games to some extent. But I think that the true story is the most effective way. And you know that's true for your own personal testimony. What are you doing in your life as you relate to people, what you're doing? People relate to people in films, but particularly so when it's a true story because they empathize with it. We're all hearing stories that automatically get our attention. I was talking to a friend this week of the importance of what's going on in Europe and why that's very relevant in terms of homeschooling. It's why it's very relevant to the American audience. So when we hear these stories of doors getting kicked in, policemen rushing in, taking out all the kids, we become very aware of those stories. These are stories that communicate to us, and they become very real to us because we automatically and immediately recognize that that could be a circumstance that we would be in. So real stories really work, and you know, if we can get someone crying on camera, that's always like, producers love that. You know, if someone cries, we're like, yes. Anyway, the other cool thing about documentaries is the information's packaged. You know, so you have, if you were to sit down with someone, maybe you got a meal with someone, and they're public schoolers, you're homeschoolers, you've only got a particular amount of time, and maybe it's an hour and a half, that's the length of our film, what are you going to say in that hour and a half? It's very difficult to just, well, first, it's hard to talk about that for an hour and a half to someone, but what we've done is delivered this package, which works in the sense that, oh, sorry, I've got a phone call. Sorry about that. Failed rule number one. Turn off your cell phones. Yeah. So the packaged information. So what we create is this little thing. It's kind of like a tract, but it's way better than a tract because you give it to someone, there's a chance they'll actually watch it. When you give people a tract, it goes in the trash can often, sometimes not. You give people a book, hardly anyone reads it. You know, I never read the books I'm giving. It's like it's really hard to find the time to read. And people are not, I mean, who reads books that contradict everything they believe? It's very hard to convince them, but they will watch a movie. And they will listen to you, and they'll listen to you through a movie. I think our film goes along with the testimony of the people that are the transition, the grassroots that take it and give it. So it's almost like when you give our film to someone, you're part of the process. We are absolutely dependent upon you to deliver that film in the right manner. And so all we did was we found the key ideas, the most important issues that we think are there in the homeschooling argument, and packaged them in a film for you to use. It's easily distributed, so that's kind of a no-brainer. But in a sense, this is sort of the revolution. This is kind of the printing press revolution that we have now in our digital age, is that this message can be packaged and distributed very easily. And we hear about our films. You know, someone buys them in a church. What we hear is like, oh, I bought one and I shared it around our whole church, 200 people. I'm kind of like, wish they'd bought them. But, you know, that's fine. That's fine if it goes out there, because we know people buy them after seeing it. And we also know that the big deal is getting that message out there of people seeing it. It's very easy to pass along a DVD. So we know how many we've sold. We would probably guess there's at least four times as many people have seen it, you know, the people that hold screenings of the film. So that's how it works. When we talk about, you know, here's what I think about making films, documentary films. I believe we're presenting a case. So it's like a court case, like Perry Mason. I don't know if he's a lawyer. Is he a lawyer? Perry Mason. So, you know, you're there and you're in front of the jury and you have to persuade them. And there's different types of things that persuade different types of people. So we can't just go in with one argument. One of the mistakes I think a lot of Christian filmmakers make, and I made myself with my early films, was I have an opinion. I'm going to find 15 people with the exact same opinion to represent what I want to say in this film. And those people will look exactly like me in the sense that they're white and middle class and all the rest of it, and educated, whatever. That's the kind of person, that's how a lot of films are made, where instead of looking for expert and eyewitnesses that have particular leverage in the mind of the jury, where you have an opportunity to really persuade people, the mistake is to just load your film full of pundits with opinion. And opinions aren't as important as evidence. Evidence is what leverages your case in a courtroom. And probably if there's lawyers, and I'll probably butcher all of this, my illegalese. But my opinion is you have an ability when you're before a jury to persuade them. And they're all different people. They're different classes, different colors, race, whatever, different gender. That's an important one. You know, in our films, we are very aware that there's an argument that will have leverage with women and another argument with leverage with men. And we don't know, I mean, it definitely could cross over, could definitely be different, but it's our job as good lawyers to go into the courtroom and be aware that you have to be as persuasive as possible. And the two types of witnesses are expert and eyewitnesses. You know, there's biblical principle in terms of how do you make a case, you know, two or three witnesses. We believe we definitely should have two or three. In our case, we make our film up from an abundance of individuals who make the case. The experts are people who know more about the subject than anyone else, so they have credentials, so that you're able to put them in your film. They're not just as we used to do it, where we'd say, let's get Joe to be in the film because he believes this, you know, and he would be in the film. You have to be in the film. You have to merit your position on that stand as you take the stand. So the expert witnesses, and in a court case, that would be the forensic scientists and people like that. Eyewitnesses have even more leverage, I think, in making a case, and we have whistleblowers particularly. The whistleblower is someone who, you know, we've seen some of the recent cases of whistleblowers like Snowden and Assange and all the stuff that's going on there. In our sphere, the whistleblowers are the teachers who come out of the public school system, and these teachers are very important because, well, when we released Indoctrination, one of our worries was when we would get anger, teachers, Christian teachers are still in the public schools because we we kind of rebuke them in the film. We criticize them. We make the point that that's the wrong tactic at the very least. What's interesting is when we go meet those people and they show up and they're still working in the public schools and they'll come up and talk to me after the film, and what they almost always say is it's much worse. My school, this happens. Now, what happens is the people that know, and I don't know if you know, but public school teachers homeschool and private school at a higher rate than the rest of the population. That would be like people in Apple use Microsoft more than the people in the rest of the population. That doesn't happen. Public schools, it happens. Congressmen and senators don't use public schools either. So, you know, these are the people that run the show. And they know, and I hear the stories from these teachers, and they'll say, this happened in our school, this happened in the school bathrooms, this happened on the playing field. And it's awful. And the news doesn't get out. People don't hear these stories. When you go to your local ISD's website, it will list all their achievements, not all their failures. The schools lie all the time to the parents of the children that go there. That's why we have whistleblowers who come out and say what really goes on in public schools. Oh, people believe it when they see it. That's kind of what I talked about. When people see things, it makes more sense to them. One of the other parts of evidence that we believe is important is history. It's not the most important thing. I think a lot of people just brush that aspect off, as they do when you're talking about the Constitution or other aspects of Christian history in America. When you present the argument of the corruption of the public schools from the 1800s onwards, not because Obama took office, then you know some people start to see something there, and it takes a while, but they start to get the bigger picture, and the bigger picture is our responsibility. If you know the film Indoctrination, by the way, how many people have seen Indoctrination? Raise your hand. Okay, you talk to the people that didn't put their hands up and tell them it's a good idea. They should see this film. If you haven't seen it, what we have in the film is a little bus that goes. So when we did history, now the reason we do that is history is boring for most people. It's hard to do history well in a documentary. So what did we do? We made it entertaining as possible. So that was we put a lot of time and effort into animation and motion graphics. And we have this little bus that goes along from the 1800s, actually earlier, but goes through the 1800s, picks up all these people, and like Marx and Darwin and G. Stanley Hall and all these guys. And it goes along up to Obama and Hitler comes on. And so we didn't call it this in the film, but in the production we called it the Bus of Reprobates, meaning that it was this bus full of all these awful people. And the message there is don't put your child on the bus. The bus is completely loaded with an ideology or these individuals who have absolutely influenced the progress of the public school. So making history, if you're a documentarian in the room, make your history as entertaining as possible. In fact, make the whole thing as watchable as possible. I think that's the lesson that we've had to battle through. When people get a documentary, it's the last one on their list. It's the bottom of the pile. And on top of that is Avengers and Spider-Man and Batman and all the rest of it. And right at the bottom might be, maybe, your film. So we have to make sure that the word of mouth about our film is like, there's something interesting about this film. It's not a bore. It's, you know, it's not a burden to watch. So our effort is to make it interesting. The way we do that is we change the scene every 5 minutes. You know, you're not no more than 5 minutes on one subject. We have multiple characters, so we're never seeing one person on screen for too long. We interject with, you know, good animations and music and throw in a few jokes and all, and then we create a dramatic ending, which if you haven't seen the film, I won't spoil it for you, but we create a dramatic ending, which makes it more memorable and easier to pass along. The two arguments in the film that we try and refute are SNL and NIMS. Anyone know what SNL is? As an what argument in favor of the public schools would that be? SNL. Why I use the public schools, and the argument they give is the SNL argument. Any ideas? No, salt and light is the argument. So you were thinking of my argument against them, which would be true, socialism. Salt and light is the argument they give for being in the public schools. So, you know, the big thing about documentaries, you go 1.5 hours, you got to make your case. It's not like a book where you can just throw everything in it. You got to be very careful of what are the key arguments that people use for the public schools. First one being salt and light. And then NIMS. Anyone got a guess for NIMS? Not in my school, correct. So not in my school is the other one. That's the Texas argument, isn't it? And then we got to point to the alternatives. When we started indoctrination, we wanted it to be a film where the first half of the film will demolish the public schools, and the second half of the film will show how great homeschooling is. Of course, there was so much material on and work that we had to do to deal with the public school system that had to be the film. We couldn't do this other film. It might be a sequel or something, we're not sure yet, but the other aspect, and in some sense, the other aspect is kind of up to you. There's multiple ways to do homeschooling, and it's a very personal thing, so we're not going to set just in stone what we think you should do. But in terms of the film, we did have to point to alternatives, but we did that. Everyone, you know, we stated very clearly in the film, I'm a homeschooler, a homeschool dad, and all of that sort of stuff. You see my kids. And so we point to the alternatives. So the principle of the witness is some of the stuff we've already talked about. The requirement to observe, so that if something happened, it's very important that the individual did see it, that it's not just hearsay. So that's the priority for us, is to get people that have observed the truth. There's a requirement in Scripture to tell the truth. There's a requirement that you have more than one witness. It's very interesting that in Texas you can actually put someone in jail with one witness. That is not true for Texas. You can biblical law would require more than one witness. In Texas, as I know, because I get rejected from sitting on a jury because I brought this up. I would not find someone guilty if there was only one witness. And the judge rebuked me sharply in the court. He said, that's ridiculous. And he said, if you were out in a parking lot and I came up and mugged you and stole your wallet, there would be effectively only one witness, and that would be you. And I said, well, that's not enough. We would need other evidence. I mean, evidence is different than a witness, of course. So we need another witness to testify that actually happened. Now, it might be that someone saw the judge running away. It might not be an actual witness of that event, or it might be that the cleaner went through the judge's drawer and found my wallet, or whatever it was. There's another witness. But if you only ever have one witness, I don't think in biblical law you can convict anyone. So the purpose of our documentary is to present the truth and to be persuasive. We want to win this case like it's a jury trial. I don't know if we do that, but that's our plan. The expert witnesses, and we have an expert witness here, Samuel Blumenfeld. Now, the best part of making documentaries, which is a kind of a secret, but I'll tell you, if you want to meet all of your heroes, you just pretend you're making a documentary. It's amazing the number of people I've been able to get on the phone. I mean, I've seen people on television, and I said, I want to talk to them, and I'll be talking to them the next day because I'm making documentaries. And that's the only reason. It's kind of weird that you can just call people up. But we've talked to people that are way out of our league for sure because we're making a documentary, and they're like, oh, that sounds interesting, and we start to talk about it. And this is an example. Someone like Samuel Blumenfeld, he's one of these old guys, been around and done work forever. I mean, we're only doing the media side. In terms of intellectual capital, our films are based largely on the works of people like him. So Samuel Blumenfeld, John Taylor Gatto, and R.J. Rushdoony. And these are the guys who we just love. And these are the old guys. And these old guys that we should be listening to. So Samuel Blumenfeld's one of them. He's written on this subject. So he's one of our most important expert witnesses. He's 30-plus years on this subject. Actually, more than that, I think about it. He wrote NEA, Trojan Horse, and or NEA, Trojan Horse in American Education, and he wrote the book, Is Public Education Necessary? And, of course, his answer was no. Here's a little clip. Let me plug this in so you can get it.
This is Lexington Green.
We are here not to do with the Revolutionary War, but to do with education. Can you tell me why this site or this area has something to do with education?
Well, because of the first normal school that was built right across from here. It was the first teachers' college run by the government. As James G. Carter, one of the Harvard Unitarians, wrote, a teachers' college, a state-controlled teachers' college, can be an engine to sway the public sentiment, the public morals, and the public religion more powerful than any other in the possession of government. You see. So he knew the power that rested in having teachers being trained by the government. He said if they were being trained by the government, then they would do the government's will, which is what we have today in America, you see.
So we have a significant problem in America. We've embraced socialism, and we are far down the line, nationalized health care, all the welfare that we have, bailing out banks. And would you say it's fair to say the public schools are an engine to that process?
Well, not only that, but the public schools themselves were a form of socialism. A state government education system is a socialist system.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you can see, you know, when you get the expert witness, oh, this is another one in a minute, Jeff Potkin, but you can see their ability to speak on this issue. If I said all of that stuff, it doesn't have the credibility. In fact, a lot of the time, I don't think I have any of the credibility. My job is to bring the eyewitnesses and expert witnesses to the screen so that they can testify. In fact, the joke is in production is that I write a script and then I find people to say the things I wrote in the script. And that's absolutely true. I know what I want to say with this film. And then we go and find the people that can say it and authenticate it, though. You know, I'm just saying it out of opinion. We go find the people that will say these things, but we'll back it up with rational thoughts and experience. And so that's how we do it. And usually, in fact, almost all the time, they say it better than I would ever imagine. So when we're going meeting someone like Samuel Blumenfeld and John Taylor Gatto, they're just fantastic. So and another example is Jeff Botkin, who's a friend of mine, founder of the Western Conservatory. He's lectured on philosophy and history at Hillsdale College and a lot of been involved in the political world for a long time, and obviously a big influence on me in terms of filmmaking. So I have a short clip of...
Some of the social engineers were saying to the Christian parents, you know, you really don't want to mess up your nice Protestant society that you have here in New England. So simply send all the children to the classrooms and we'll make sure that they're uniformly Protestant. And so the Protestants began to compromise with that idea and they surrendered their children to a curriculum that was not neutral. And Boston became an experimental city for the powers of the state. And Horace Mann and others were pushing for a government-controlled education curriculum.
Horace Mann, like many of the grandchildren of these wonderful Christian pastors, was a man who rejected the Trinity. He rejected the authority of Scripture. In other words, he rejected the very thing that teaches a sound philosophy of education, the Word of God. For the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge.
Okay, so the eyewitness is really where it happens in films. The more we find of those, the better. They're not easy to find. Sometimes they contact us, and sometimes we have to really go a long way to find these stories. The two stories we have here is Sarah Laverdier, who was a public school teacher, and Lucy, who was a public school student. And the importance of her testimony, Lucy's testimony, is she was in one of the so-called good schools. You know, she was in one of the top 200 schools in America. And so we're rebuking that argument, not in my school. So that's why Lucy's testimony was important. Sarah's is important for another reason, which we'll maybe discuss after the clip. Oh, sorry.
Parents would want their child to have. She's a believer. She's kind, and she loves her students. She's doing what a lot of Christians are doing, trying to be salt and light to her young students. But she was honest about the difficulties.
The public school system culture as a whole is overwhelmingly anti-Christian. The teachers, I've heard teachers say things to students that are directly anti-Christian. There was an incident where students were calling each other gay on the playground. And a teacher handled that situation by telling the students that, well, that's okay, and you don't know, you might be gay. You don't know yet. Most people don't find out until they're older. And she was telling this to 8-year-olds. And so as a Christian, this was very difficult for me to listen to and to hear that.
Do parents know about these kinds of incidents in their children's school?
Parents, they want to think that their teachers are doing good, but they don't know what really goes on inside of the classroom. And while the public school system teaches morals, we're told that that's the most important thing that we teach, that that is the plate that all of the subjects, everything else, goes on. But what the public school system has done is taken Christ out from the morals, and so they've taken the foundation that the morals are based on away.
I asked Sarah about her struggle to be faithful to Christ in the public schools.
I can't tell the students about God. I can't give him glory for anything.
Okay. So, Sarah's a great example of an expert witness. One is you can see that it's genuine. You can see from her character and who she is. And, you know, the accent, southern accent helps and all the rest of it, because we're trying to persuade a particular group, an audience, Christian audience, who have an absolute implicit trust in the public school system because they think their teacher is a Christian. Sometimes they are in Texas, of course, Christian teachers. I'm not doubting that. I've met them, know them well, some of them. I'm friends with one, actually, a very close friend of mine. Brother-in-law, actually, is still in the public schools. And you know, hear all his stories. But with someone like Sarah, also she's female as well, which helps, I think, too, in a way. And that she's able to persuade the reality of what goes on in the public schools, and it comes across as extremely genuine. If we said the exact same thing, if I personally was on screen saying all of this, it just wouldn't work. So that's why we look for people like Sarah. I think the next clip is of Lucy. Yes, it is.
I was in 7th grade. We were coming home from school, and a boy on my bus had a handgun, mm-hmm. which scared me to death. Mm-hmm. And this is in a public school that's ranked in the top 200 in the country. And on paper, I looked like a great product of the public schools. I was a national AP scholar. I did the International Baccalaureate program. I graduated with very high GPA, but inside I was dying, and I was absolutely spiritually broken by the time I graduated from 12th grade.
So even in the good schools, the same problems of promiscuity, drugs, and violence all exist.
Okay, I go on to explain how most people rate their school higher than everyone else's school. So they say, our school's definitely better, which statistically couldn't happen. If everyone's school is better than everyone else's, that would be amazing. This is another teacher story.
Stay after school, let's do some makeup. And I won over a lot of parents that way because they could see that I cared about their child. I wanted them to learn. But then there was resistance started by some other parents.
R.C. Murray is another teacher who became frustrated with what passes for education in the public schools. His experiences inspired him to write his book called Legally Stupid.
The problem was is the ones who refused to do what I was asking them to do, actually read and actually write. The system had always set it up so that the teacher was expected to read to the students in the classroom all the way through high school. And I thought, this is not daycare. I don't need to be reading stories to seniors. A teacher was angrily making copies of something because she had to give a test to a student that had a label on him that said he was a non-reader. And this was a reading test. So for the reading test, she had to read to the student. Then she had to write down his responses verbally because he wasn't expected to write either. It is a waste of time, and yet this child will get all the way through the school system saying that he had English 1, English 2, English 3, English 4, and he's supposed to be ready for college.
A high percentage of the kids that come to us from public school, as high as 70%, have to take some form of remediation when they get to us. In other words, they got a high school education, they want to go to college, but they're not ready. And the big concern, particularly in Florida, is passing a certain test that you have to pass every year. And if enough students don't pass it, the school itself is graded as an A, B, C, or D school. If you are not an A school, you're in big trouble, you lose funding and all this kind of thing. So teaching the test becomes the issue as opposed to teaching the children.
They were supposed to do writing assignments in what is called group learning. Mixed ability grouping is what they call it. They put one in motivated child, they call it accelerated gifted child now. They put that one student in a group with three or four, they call them diverse learners. Which means that they're supposed
That's what I call my friends now.
Their learning style says that they don't learn the same way everybody else does. but really they're unmotivated students. And they put them in a group setting, give them an assignment. The accelerated gifted student will actually do all the work, but everybody gets a grade, the same grade.
The way public education is structured, it's almost impossible to satisfy that goal of career-ready or college-ready. Why should you graduate from high school not ready for either? That's just not right.
Now, when you walk through a high school or elementary school, either one, you will see pictures all over the place, and artwork and paper dolls. 40 years ago, you would see essays. You would see reports all on bulletin boards with the big A+. You know, this was what was championed back then. Learn to express yourself in writing. Not anymore.
If you have a child to raise right now, you don't want to use your child as the tool to reform the school system and then have them get an indoctrination instead of an education.
Okay, so excellent stuff. I mean, I think that these are all things that we would believe and we want to communicate. This is where media is powerful. It's very hard to rebuke these insiders. You really, the only thing you can do is say they are lying. We get one, you know, some of our hate mail, which we put on our website called Hate, M-A-L-E, when we brought out Monstrous Regiment. We got a lot of feminist writing to us, and you know, I write them back saying, well, our film, it's all women that speak in this film. What do they hate women? And they just say, no, they're all just deceived, which is an amazing thing, just to have this prognosis on all of these smart women, Jenny Chansey and, you know, Phyllis Schlafly, that they're all just, you know, naive, deceived people. But that's what you're left. You end up with a situation where you can only really say these guys are lying. You know, Lucy didn't see a gun. Lucy didn't see drugs. You know, these are the things you end up, we hear more often. There's no other conclusion. So Salt and Light, this is the Not in My School. Salt and Light's the other story. Of course, Mike Matarko, who we found out about while we're making the film, and his story is particularly unique because the Salt and Light argument is that, if we can get in the right position, we can change the whole structure of the school. Here's someone who was in that position to change the structure of the school, or at least a significant impact upon it. But you really have to listen to his testimony, and we'll play a clip of Mike.
Elementary principal, chief cook and bottle washer. It's a small school. We're always in the top 10%. We're a national blue ribbon school through the Department of Education. We have people come to us and say, yeah, we're coming here because you're the top school in the state and this is where we want our kids to go.
I asked them, how exactly are you being salt and light as a Christian and as a principal of a government school?
I do have a conflict at times between God's law and man's law. I'm in front of the dike, and there are pinholes and cracks starting in the dike. And what I'm doing with the anti-defamation league, I put my finger in that little hole and I stop it. And what I'm doing with after school, with the program for a Good News Club, putting my finger in that hole and stopping it. And now I'm standing here holding back the water up here, but yet I'm realizing I look down and the whole foundation of the dike is crumbling out from under me, because the foundation's not built upon God, not built upon His Word, not built upon His truths. It's built upon man, man's desires, man's wants. So I'm on shaky ground, and I have a hard time with that. Yes, in the morning we do pledge the flag and have a moment of silence. And in that moment of silence, I pray. I make sure that I'm out where other people can see me, and I am bowing my head and I am praying. Really, that's the only area anymore that God is in the schools.
Okay. I don't have a clip of Vody, but, you know, Vody's probably the person who is most famous for his proclamation of Not in My School. That's where we stole it from. I mean, Vody's obviously been a big influence on us, and we have a little clip in the film, which I won't play you, but he outlines this issue. You know, everyone uses this argument, so it was very perceptive of Vody to pick up on that, and we borrowed it from him. Now, the big part of our film, if you've seen it, as you know, is Brian Rohrbaugh's testimony. Now, Brian has become a good friend of mine. We were privileged to have him come to a few of the screenings. He's a huge supporter of the film, which is very difficult. You imagine the circumstances with someone like Brian, who, you know, has things which I think you would, most of us would want to leave in the past. But the amazing thing about Brian, if you don't know the story, he lost his son at Columbine, and he wanted to talk to us. Immediately, he actually interviewed us before we interviewed him. He wanted to know how we were going to use his argument. And what's very interesting about Brian is he rightly points to the culprit within this whole scenario. And it's not that there isn't just, there is the responsibility of the murderers in this story, and he doesn't in any way deny that. But what he makes it clear is there's was a responsibility on him, and he takes that responsibility by knowing what the public school believed, knowing what they taught in the schools, especially in that school where there was a very clear consequence of the teaching of evolutionary theory and nihilistic ideology, and that working its way out in this this massacre. And so his testimony is just so valuable. So we were very blessed to get him to talk to us, and I think I have a clip of what he talked about.
A little over 6 years ago, we adopted our two precious children in Ukraine, and we have been blessed in an unimaginable way by God. And we made the commitment before we went that we will homeschool these kids, that no matter what we have to do, there is no chance that they will ever set foot into a government school.
Mr. Rorba has a very good reason for feeling so strongly about the public schools.
I was a single father, divorced, with one son, Daniel, and I was a Christian, a believer, but very weak, lukewarm. My son was in a public school. Quite often, after school, I'd pick up my son, or my coworker would pick up my son, and he'd come over to my shop.
Well, let's take a walk up here.
When it was time to leave, we closed up the shop, and Dan said, "Hey, I'm kind of hungry." And I said, "Well, call your mom and be sure it's okay, and that you're not missing dinner or something, and we can get something to eat." And he said, "Well, that's all right. I'll eat dinner anyway." So we stopped and got something, and we sat in the truck and talked for a while. And then I dropped him off at his mom's house. And when he was getting out, he looked, jumped out of the truck, and he said, "I love you, Dad. I'll see you tomorrow." And I said, "I love you too, Dan. I'll see you tomorrow." And then I backed out of the driveway, and I looked up just as he was going in the house, and he stopped with the door open and waved with a big smile. And those were the last words I ever said to my son. On the morning of April 20th, before noon, I received a phone call. And in a panic-stricken voice, Dan's mom said to me, "Brian, have you heard from Dan? Do you know what's going on?" And I said, "No." And she told me that two gunmen had entered Columbine High School with machine guns and hand grenades, and they were killing kids. And so me and my coworker dropped what we were doing, and we headed towards the school. And we got to where we could look across a park and see the school, and there were two police cars there blocking our way, and we couldn't go any further. And we stood there watching, and a lady burst out her front door, and she was screaming and crying, and she said to the police, "Save that boy. Do something. Save that boy." And that's really where I realized how bad things were. We heard they were going to start bringing school buses. And the first bus came, and I watched as the kids got off. And they'd run to their parents, and they'd cry, and they'd hug. And all too often, I heard this hollow promise, that "You'll never set foot in that school again." When the last bus came, it was empty. When the next morning came, we opened the newspaper, and there was a picture of a young man wearing a green shirt and blue jeans, lying dead on the sidewalk. It was my son. That was our only notification. I knew how bad the public schools were, and I knew that because I was in the public schools. And as parents, I think we want to believe that things have gotten better when, in fact, they have gotten much worse. It was my responsibility to make sure that my son was safe, that he was educated properly. But I failed that. I put him in a pagan school where they teach there is no God. There is no creation. There's evolution based on a cosmic accident. And evolution breaks down to one simple belief, and that is that the strong kill the weak as a form of survival, and that there's nothing wrong with that.
Both of the killers, Klebold and Harris, had received good grades from their Columbine High teachers for their graphically violent writings. They showed their violent videos in the school classroom with approval. One of them wore a t-shirt emblazoned with the words natural selection, the other with the word wrath. Ideas do have consequences.
They had taken evolution much further than most people do, but if you stop and think through it, their logic was correct if evolution is true. And yet it is taught in the school, and I put my son there. Even though I'm a Christian. So, when we talk about my son's murder, yes, it's right to condemn these two murderers. It's right to condemn the school system that taught these wicked things. But you must remember, I'm the one who put him there. And I'm the one who's responsible for his death.
Since Dan's death, there has been over 400 school-associated violent deaths all over America. Michael Moore and the liberal media would have you believe the problem is with guns. How many commentators have you heard mention the schools themselves as a key culprit?
There are many ways to destroy a child, and it may have taken a school shooting to wake us up, to see the danger. But that's a very small danger compared to all the other things that go on that can destroy our children.
Okay, so that's Brian Rohrbuff's testimony. I think, you know, obviously it's very emotionally charged. I think he, more than anyone, has earned the right to be able to talk about this issue. I think he rightly points to the broader culprit. There's a big story there. Backstory in terms of how Columbine worked its way out, in terms of the, you know, Brian had to sue multiple times the city to get the information about what actually happened to his son, because, you know, who works for the city? Well, the public schools and the police, fire services, all of those groups were the parties involved in first on the scene in Columbine. And I'm not alluding to a cover-up. I'm not sure if there's a cover-up. It's possible there might be more to the story. What is apparent from all of the stuff that has been released is how much those boys were off the rails very early on, and why it would be obvious to anyone. This is the whole thing about the public schools that we're saying to people all the time. You cannot vet the peers of the children that your little Johnny or Jill will be spending their time with. You don't know what's going on in those homes, and until you can be certain, you cannot vouch for the safety of the public school system. And we tell pastors this especially. We tell pastors they have to tell people. I think pastors have a responsibility to tell their congregation and to guard the hearts and safety of their congregation. So we believe it's on them. And unless they can vouch for the safety of every child within their congregation that goes to public schools and vouch for their safety, spiritual safety, as well as physical safety, then they are doing a disservice if they don't communicate an anti-public school message that we have. But a lot of them don't. And I think it'll be on them. It'll be a large part of the responsibility of what can happen to children in the public schools on these pastors who have kept silent. So what can you do? Be militant and gracious. That means, you know, be out there doing things. Be forceful. Know that the Lord is with you, but be gracious when you do it. A lot of this, the truth is, most of the people when we present the information, the indoctrination film, is that they have no idea. They've never heard it in their questions at the end. They have never, ever heard of this story at all. They've never heard anyone criticize the public schools. They've never heard anything wrong with them. And so you might be the first person that you meet to present a message like this to them. So bear that in mind when you talk to people. You will meet the hardened, diehard defenders of the public school based on ideology, but they are rare. I probably meet more of those just because of the work that I do, but the average person, the average Texan, just doesn't think about it. You know, they're living the American life, so they're not quite there yet. Be an evangelist for homeschooling, so go out there and do what you can. Use our books and DVDs, certainly Blumenfeld, Gatto, and Short. If you want to know a lot more about this subject, those are the guys, along with R.J. Rushdooney. They're the guys to see. I'm not at the Master's Books booth. That's an old slide. But Master Books is our publisher. We publish the book. We're selling the book and the movie together. And we also have our other films. If you want to know about those, you can go to colingunn.com and have them here as well. So we have 6 films all together right now. We're working on 7 and 8 right now. But we have different subjects that we've covered there.